Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. And a special thank you to subscribers to the show who make our mission possible and also who are apparently way ahead of your time, because one of the topics we're going to talk about today is the absolute collapse of corporate media. So if you're here, that tells me you either anticipated it or thought that the media collapsed a long time ago. So we're going to talk about this. I'm not going to say I foretold this, but I've had sort of a thought about what the arc of the corporate media was going to be when it started to sort of go on the decline. So I want to talk about where it's at right now, and obviously the Tucker Carlson news and the Don Lemon news, for what that's worth. But what I see on the horizon, like 5 to 10 years from now, and then and Nicole, I want you to save this clip, and then 5 to 10 years from now, we'll bring it back up and see if I was right or not. Also, just a few minutes ago, Governor Jay Inslee signed a number of gun control laws in Washington State. So we're going to play some of the comments that were made both by Washington State's Attorney General, who proactively remarked on the legal challenges that are sure to ensue. Biden, as we expected and talked about on the show yesterday, announced his bid for re-election today, for the love of all things. Also coming up, I posted an op-ed to Patreon and Locals for subscribers that looked at the real confusion that Washington state government has about what kids are capable of consenting to without their parents. And I think it shows just an inconsistency across the board in what the government says, yes, this kid can do on their own, or no, this kid has to have a parent's consent in writing or a parent be present. So I'm going to go over some of that for those of you who aren't subscribers who did not get a chance to read that article. Nicole, how are you?
Hey, Brandy, I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm well. You know, I'm feeling good today. I was feeling really springy. If you're watching the show, I've got my nice spring color. I'm starting to fold the spring colors into the wardrobe,
light
pinks and blues and stuff.
I'm excited for 70-something degrees at the end of the week.
Over the rain. Absolutely over the rain. Now, before you go and I jump into the bill signings, one thing on the gun control bills. Mm-hmm. So the press conference was at 10:30 this morning. I'm going to get into the content of the press conference, but there was something interesting going on behind the scenes. So I read a tweet saying that the Capitol was going to be on lockdown. Mm-hmm. I mean, just not open to the public until noon, out of an abundance of caution while these bills on gun control, including a ban on semi-automatic assault rifles, was signed into law.
Right.
So, of course, when I saw that, I said, gosh, was there a threat? Because to close the Capitol to the public during a bill signing, I guess I can't remember a time when that's happened. I'm not saying there hasn't been, but I just don't recall that ever happening.
Right.
So you reached out to the governor's office to inquire about what prompted this, and you just heard back from them.
Right. I did ask. We saw the alert saying that it was out of an abundance of caution. Were there threats made, and can you share any more about the decision? And the response I got was the closure was out of an abundance of caution. To ensure the security of those on site during the bill action this morning. So, no.
I mean, I take that to mean no, there wasn't anything specific. Now, mm-hmm. if there was, I would hope that they would at least suggest it to not leave us like flailing in the wind, because how that strikes me is fear-mongering. If there weren't mm-hmm. any specific threats toward this bill signing or an issue, it strikes me as fear-mongering because they're signing bills that are going to take people's constitutional rights away to own certain types of firearms, that they're almost fear-mongering to say, we're worried somebody would come shoot up the bill signing.
Right.
Which,
because people that are opposing this are so terrible.
But
that's
also
what they're implying.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that seems very wrong to me. And so as much as I hope there weren't threats, that to me is the only way to justify that, because they sign a lot of controversial bills into law, and I've never seen them do that.
And there are security measures that are taken every day there. So why are they less effective, I guess? Right?
Well, I mean, you can walk into the Capitol whenever you want, you know, presumably,
right.
but they're saying you can't for this period of time. And so I just don't. And I'm curious your thoughts if you're consuming the show live today, if you want to share your thoughts on Facebook, YouTube, Patreon, or Locals, as to whether that also strikes you as odd, that they would, out of an abundance of caution because you're signing bills related to guns, close down the Capitol from being accessible to the public.
If there's
for no reason.
No threat.
Right. It's a little odd. So, mm-hmm. okay. Thank you for reaching out to them, Nicole, and for getting that. And thank you to the governor's press team for responding, although that doesn't give us a whole lot of information besides abundance of caution, which is just a throwaway line. All right. Let's talk about the bills that were signed by the governor. And he waited to do, you know, this big bill signing ceremony because this is an issue the governor, Washington State's attorney general, has been pushing on for a long time. There were several bills signed. The big one, of course, is the ban on semi-automatic. Why do I have a hard time saying that? Semi-automatic assault weapons. Maybe that's why they call it assault weapons, because it's just easier to say. So anyway, a few notable remarks. Obviously, this has been Attorney General Bob Ferguson's pet project since like 2016 or something. He's repeatedly kind of handed this over to Democrats to introduce on his behalf. So naturally, the man who wants to be Washington State's next governor, I wonder when that announcement will come, spoke. And at the end of his remarks, he addressed the likelihood that this is going to turn into a prolonged legal battle on constitutional grounds.
We understand there will be lawsuits challenging the ban on the sale of assault weapons. My team told me, I think one's been filed already, that's to be expected, and that's their right. That's the way our system works. We're a nation of laws, and they have the right to challenge that. I will just remind them and everybody in this room that we have, in the AG's office, we defend all bills passed by the legislature and by the people through the initiative process, and we have defended a number of bills related to common sense gun reform, and our record so far is pretty good against the NRA and against the Second Amendment Foundation. We are undefeated, and we plan to keep that record intact. Thank you so much, Eric, for your support.
He loves this. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, he's loving this, because not only is he going to probably imminently announce, I imagine Governor Jay Inslee is waiting to say he's not going to run again until the legislative session is completely buttoned up. There's still a lingering issue around drug possession that he's trying to get them together on. But as soon as that happens, Bob Ferguson will enter the race. And this timing could not be better for him from his perspective. To have had this legislative victory he's been trying to get for years, be able to stand up there and say, we're standing up to the NRA and the gun lobby, and then have these legal challenges that are going to be taking place throughout probably the entirety of his time running. And he's going to use that to try to galvanize support for him, to get donations, et cetera, et cetera. And at this point, look, I try to be nice. Am I a nice person?
Yes, I think you're a nice person.
That's the only answer that you could give. I don't have a personal problem with Bob Ferguson in terms of, like, I've talked about this. I've met him. I think he's a nice guy if you pluck him out of the political atmosphere he's in, and is a nice family man, all that.
Right.
But I am terrified about the fact that he's probably going to be governor.
So is that worse than Inslee to you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is worse than Inslee. Because Inslee, to me, for instance, on this whole issue with Democrats not being able to come together on a drug possession thing, Inslee clearly has no pull, no political capital to be able to get something as simple as that done. But I feel like Bob Ferguson is, A, incredibly intelligent. He truly is. And he's going to take, you know, his sort of legal background and his work as attorney general to make sure that whatever he wants to push through is on good legal standing. Right. And so I just think he's a little more dangerous in that regard because he's less harmless.
So why aren't you begging Inslee to run again?
I mean, I don't think...
You said you're not doing it. You're not doing it. That would be crazy. I feel like you told him that, right?
Yeah.
In some
It's interesting.
Words.
I haven't thought of that. I mean, he's not going to listen to me, obviously. But do I think... Oh, wow. Do I think a fourth term of Jay Inslee would be worse than the prospect of Bob Ferguson? That's really tough.
I know. I would rather have Inslee.
I mean, I would rather have Inslee run because I think he's more beatable. After 4 years, I mean, even reasonable people are like, no, dude, you don't get a fourth term.
We had a little bit of a discussion about this because I think Inslee is more likable than Ferguson. So I think Ferguson is more beatable because people like a likable person. That's what people go for.
You don't, but you think from a Democratic perspective, you think that Democrats don't find Bob Ferguson likable? What's not likable from a, obviously there's political things not to like about him, but I'm talking about purely from the stance of Democratic voters.
He just doesn't come off, I think he is a dad. Is he a dad?
Yeah.
But he doesn't come off as that fatherly figure that Inslee comes off as. And it's like a Biden thing, too. I think Biden comes off as a very likable dude because he's like everybody's grandpa, and that's why he wins. Obama won because I think he's a likable dad, father figure-y dude, right?
This is an interesting – we're totally off the rails from our top story of the day, but this is really interesting to me because I don't look at Bob Ferguson and think unlikable. You know, he's got the little glasses and he's just – I mean, I'm totally politics aside and all of that.
Right.
I don't see that.
Because I think I think people want somebody more relatable when they pick somebody to represent
is
them.
Is Jay Inslee relatable?
Well,
you're talking about like his doofy comments and like his Jayisms, as we call them.
Yeah. Okay. And his, like, all right. Fatherly figure, that type of thing. And I think that he comes off more as Ferguson comes off more as, you know, an attorney, like very serious, very business.
It's like
very,
a little sanctimonious, yeah, which so, I can be a little sanctimonious too. I try to work on that.
And when you pick somebody to represent you, which I think, you know, it's a working class, parents, whatever, even both sides, you're looking for somebody that's more relatable, that represents you.
Well,
I don't know.
We're going to have a lot of time to discuss that. I'd be curious to hear your guys' thoughts on that. But let's get back to the gun control issue in the comments and speeches that were given today. So Senator Jamie Peterson has been big behind this effort, and he talked about his bill, which has to do with holding gun manufacturers and dealers accountable for how weapons are used. Here's what he said.
It imposes on them liability for a failure to impose reasonable controls on those firearms. So if you think you're going to sell high-capacity magazines, guess what? Now the Attorney General has a new tool to make sure that you can't do that or to sell assault weapons if you're a retailer. If you're a manufacturer who's going to target youth with a message about how cool it is to go shoot assault weapons, guess what? You may have some responsibility the next time that there is a mass shooting.
Who's doing that? Did I miss something? And genuinely, if I've missed a story on gun manufacturers telling kids how cool it is to shoot assault weapons, can somebody send it to me? Who's doing that?
Video games, but
That's not a gun manufacturer.
Not manufacturers.
And in fact,
exactly.
You know, he even said that, you know, now there's a new tool if you want to sell a high-capacity magazine or a semi-automatic assault rifle. Well, yeah, but the tool is the law. Now they're against the law. Mm-hmm. So you don't need an additional tool. And you're acting as if firearms dealers would go behind the government's back, actually legitimate businesses, and would risk their license to sell something that's already banned under state law. That doesn't make any sense. Please, someone, let's reach out. Can you take a note? Mm-hmm. We got to reach out to Senator Peterson's office and ask if he has an example of gun manufacturers who are telling kids how cool it is to shoot, quote, weapons of war. Noted? Okay. That's so bizarre to me. Bills in search of a problem. Solutions in search of a problem is like half of what lawmakers in Olympia pass. It's like, they're like, this sounds like a good idea with no care or concern for whether it actually is going to stop behavior that may or may not exist. It's so weird. So one more person who I want to pinpoint who spoke, Representative Liz Berry, represents part of Seattle. And she talked about, you know, running and what her motivation was, in part because of crimes that were committed with guns. Listen.
I ran for office 3 years ago because I was angry. I was heartbroken. I was devastated. I wanted to do something about it. Too many of our friends and neighbors are being killed by gun violence in our communities, and that is unacceptable.
Like, okay, yeah, I think there's too many shootings happening, for sure, too many homicides happening, so I'm all aboard with that. I think that's a great reason to run for office. So what is the bill that you put forth that you think would help solve that problem, ma'am?
I'm here to talk about my bill 1143, which will implement a 10-day waiting period and mandatory safety training for all firearm purchases.
Oh, yes, the gang members, they're going to go take safety courses with their guns that they're just getting off someone on the street. And this is what, and again, like, I'm all for, like, I think people should know how to use a firearm, you know, and take the initiative to get training. And I think the vast majority, the vast, vast, vast majority of legal gun owners and law-abiding citizens do that. Criminals aren't going to follow this anyway. And they're not. You're not, you know, it's like when they push the idea for permits to buy a gun. Like, you're not going to have a gang member who's like waiting in line for a permit to buy a gun, or is going to wait 10 days. Like, hey, man, we need to commit this drive-by shooting. So I'll do it in 11 days because I got to go away for that's so dumb. I mean, if the goal is to save lives, I get it. I think that's an honorable goal. But you focus on these things that, you know, like the ban on assault weapons. when you look at the spike in shootings and homicides in Washington state and even suicides, it's not happening with those weapons. It's simply not. And so, look, if you want to tell me that you want to reduce the number of crimes committed with a gun, let's be honest about what's happening. And let's also make sure that you're not simultaneously supporting proposals that reduce punishments for people who actually do commit crimes with a gun. You know, one of the bills that passed in the House and Senate this year is a bill, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about it in a different segment later on a totally different angle of it, but it's a bill that would make sure that juvenile offenders, if you're not familiar with how our criminal justice system works, offenders get scores. They get scored based on crimes they've committed. And then as they continue to commit crimes, which many of them do, their offender score is used to decide where in the sentencing range their sentence is going to fall. So the higher the score, you're probably going to get a sentence that's on the higher end of the sentencing range. And one of the things that Democrats supported in Olympia this year that passed the House and the Senate is to say, okay, if you commit a crime as a juvenile, even violent felonies, with the exception of homicide, that your offender score you rack up as a juvenile does not carry on to adulthood. So you could have someone who commits armed robbery as a juvenile, and you're saying, oh, we're just going to kind of wipe that clean, and that the offender score that they would have got for that isn't going to count when they commit an armed robbery as an adult. So again, I just sort of, I really wonder why you have these lawmakers who say, you know, gun control, gun control, gun control, but they are not enforcing the laws they already have on the books to help save lives. And they are actively ignoring some of the more common things that contribute to gun violence on our streets. So I just have a hard time taking them seriously. And look, if they were enforcing everything, throwing the book at gun offenders, et cetera, and then they came back and said, hey, here's some things we think will tighten up the system, I would be more amenable to listening to their arguments. But as is, I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. Okay, I'm sorry, I just had a state lawmaker call me. You should know that I'm on the air. I hope it's not urgent. Okay, let's move on to the Biden for re-election situation. We knew this was coming. There had been news reports last week that Biden was going to announce as early as Tuesday. It is Tuesday. And he announced his re-election by putting out a video on social media. I'm not going to play the whole thing, but I'll play a big chunk of it.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Personal freedom is fundamental to who we are as Americans.
There's nothing more important, nothing more sacred.
That's been the work of my first term, to fight for our democracy.
This shouldn't be a red or blue issue.
To protect our rights, to make sure that everyone in this country is treated equally and that everyone is given a fair shot at making it. But you know, around the country, MAGA extremists are lining up to take on those bedrock freedoms, cutting Social Security that you paid for your entire life while cutting taxes for the very wealthy, dictating what healthcare decisions women can make, banning books, and telling people who they can love, all while making it more difficult for you to be able to vote. When I ran for president 4 years ago, I said we're in a battle for the soul of America, and we still are. The question we're facing is whether in the years ahead we have more freedom or less freedom, more rights or fewer. I know what I want the answer to be, and I think you do too. This is not a time to be complacent. That's why I'm running for re-election.
Yeah, there's where to begin. This idea that Democrats are the party that is going to give us more freedom, not less, is just ridiculous on its face. I mean, we all went through the pandemic. We all lived through that period of time. And we know how quickly the government, for the majority of it under Democrats, was willing to take our rights away in a way most of us have never seen before. That being said, you know, I do think Republicans need to seriously, in some states, contemplate whether they're living up to what should be their core mission of government, limited government, interference in our lives. And, you know, for instance, on the transgender issue, as much as I am opposed to the government cutting parents out of the decision of kids when it comes to that issue, I'm also opposed to Republican governors that want to cut parents out by saying no one has a say in it because it's not allowed under the age of 18. I think
deferring and giving, saying if you believe in parental freedom, you have to believe in a parent's freedom to be able to make that choice with their child. So again, I think Republicans could stand to let go of some of the culture wars that eventually lead to the degradation of individual freedoms. But the idea that Democrats are somehow the party that's going to give us more freedom is just ludicrous on its face. That being said, you know, it's the age issue for me. I don't understand what's going on here. I talked about it a little bit on the show yesterday. I think that I hate talking about death because I don't want to, like, I'm not wishing death on the president, obviously. If the CIA is watching, that's clearly not the case, but you just cannot argue that he is mentally competent to continue. I mean, already, but to continue to do the job for 4 more years until 2028. That's insane. That's just insane.
I don't think that's just based on age, because there are some 90-year-olds who are
100%
sharper than Biden. But Biden is proving that that's not, there's something going on there, and you can tell it's not hidden. It's not like he can hide it as well as he thinks he can hide it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the same reason. Democrats have said that they want Dianne Feinstein to go away because she's having health issues that means that she cannot continue to serve the people of her district. It's the same thing with Biden. What I think is going on, and again, I kind of feel bad even like putting this out there because I don't want to even ever talk about a president dying, but he's of a certain age and he's clearly having some health issues. I think that they know that he's probably not ultimately going to run, whether that's because he gets to the point where he's like, listen, you know, I can't do the job anymore. And I think that that would help ingratiate voters to Kamala Harris. Where right now, if they just ditch him and go with her, voters can be like, she's totally not capable of doing the job. But if something were to happen to Biden or his health really starts to deteriorate where he has to step down or step aside from running again, I think that that helps to ingratiate Democrats to the vice president.
Why would they want her to run, though? I don't understand. She's not proving herself as a great candidate for them.
What option do they have? Because she is a black woman. He gave her that job based on the color of her skin. I mean, he said that.
Absolutely.
He acknowledged that. That's not me saying that.
Right.
And so when you are a party that has built nearly everything you do around identitarianism, and on the color of people's skin, on their gender, on their sexual orientation, and I should say he gave her the job because she's a black woman, because he's like, I'm pledged to have a woman for VP. When you have built an entire party around identitarianism, how do you, if Biden says he's not going to run as a party, say, well, Kamala, you're not running either? You can't do it. You've backed yourself into a corner on that issue where you cannot, as a party, step over who would be the likely, you know, successor, the vice president, and she is a black woman. They've done that to themselves.
I guess.
So they're stuck.
I think you're right. But then at the same time, if they really want, it depends on what you want out of it, right? Because I think that Gavin Newsom has a better chance to win, right? So I don't know.
But he's a white dude.
I know.
He's a white dude. So are they going to allow him to challenge a black woman who's the vice president, who in any other situation, the vice president would be the successor that a party would choose? But she is a black woman, and they have done this to themselves.
You're right. They've done it to themselves.
It's identitarianism, and that's why you pick the person who's best for the job based on their actual skill and not the color of their skin or their gender. It's bizarre. So I don't know. I think that's what they're trying to do is how can we make Kamala Harris more likable to the base and to independents? And might it be that when Joe Biden deteriorates to the point where he can't run, I'm sorry, I feel so bad. Because like you said, there are people of his age who are just fine. But
I think
they're
okay with him winning and then something happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then Kamala Harris gets the job just by default. But I think they know that she can't win the job just on the merits. That's sort of my thought.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's absurd. And this is also one of the big issues I have with the two-party system. And it's going to happen to Washington State, too. Like, if Jay Inslee were to run for a fourth term, Democrats wouldn't challenge him. So you basically have this deference to the person who's already in the seat, where it leaves all these people who'd be much better at the job, much better suited for the job, where they just wait in the wings and they wait for their turn and they wait until the party tells them that they can run. It's like pat, pat, pat. And to me, it robs people. It robs Americans of better public servants by doing it that way. I mean, we've had Jay Inslee, by the time he's done, the same dude for 12 years. because of the party system and the way it operates. There are much better Democrats than Jay Inslee to run the state. But that's the way it works. And that's why I'm so vehemently opposed to party identification in terms of, I mean, personally for myself, I don't care if you guys identify with a party, just because I really think that it always prioritizes the party over what's best for people. So anyway, Biden says he's running in 2024. I don't know what's up. I don't think they actually anticipate that he's going to serve a second year or a second term as president. Okay, now to what's happening in the media. And I want to take some time to really explain to you guys what I think the arc is going to be of this complete corporate media meltdown. And in fact, I might add a little live poll to the YouTube chat for you guys to take momentarily. But obviously, Don Lemon fired by CNN. And then we now know that Tucker was actually fired by CNN. When we had the news yesterday, I thought, nah, this had to be his own choice. This had to be his own choice, because why would Fox fire its cash cow? But now it turns out, and Nicole, you've been reading up a little bit on this as well, so if you want to hop into the conversation, we now know that Fox did indeed fire him. And from the articles that I've read, it was sort of a combination of things like Dominion and the lawsuits and lawsuits that are to come, but also his texts that were revealed as part of it, where he was calling Sidney Powell, see you next Tuesday. And like, they just used a combination of things to sort of make their case to fire him. And my understanding is it was like out of the blue.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. I know he spoke the night before and there was no indication that anything big was coming. He was planning the next day's show, talking about it. So yeah, I don't think it was coming. And then it's still a fairly, I mean, it's still a shocking choice because they paid him out for his contract, right? So that's $20 million a year, I think, something along those lines that he's getting paid out. So they not only lose money in the backlash from it and the stock and all that, tanking, but then they also have to pay him anyway. So it's a strange choice. I don't know. It's just this caving to
what though? Fox wouldn't cave to pressure on the left, because why? That's not your audience anyway. So it's very strange. It makes no sense. There's a bunch of people on social media now who are posting screenshots of them deleting their subscription to Fox Nation. And like you said, the stocks, I mean, they lost like almost $1 billion, like instantaneously,
and
it felt
absolutely
like.
Absolutely will go somewhere and do great.
Right.
But
that's the thing is, and I was reading a lot on this, and Megyn Kelly, who obviously, you know, went from Fox to NBC, got fired over cancel culture, and then started her own thing. She was saying Tucker will be just fine. And in fact, Tucker, he on his website, if you go, because he hasn't tweeted since this, at least at my last check, Tucker Carlson hasn't sent out any new tweets. But if you go to tuckercarlson.com, it actually has a little thing that pops up that says, text Tucker to 44055 to become a tuckercarlson.com insider to find out what Tucker's up to next. So I get the sense that Tucker can make and knows he can make much more money on his own. I mean, completely. Glenn Beck was saying that when he left, he got like 300,000 subscribers almost like just in a few days. And so I think that we've reached a point. And you notice how we're not talking about Don Lemon, because it's just sort of like, okay, I don't think that Don Lemon didn't have the heft that Tucker Carlson had. And even people on the left who might have liked Don Lemon, they're not really arguing for him. It's just like, oh, he's gone. Like, that's news. But with Tucker Carlson, it's much more than just a news story. It's like, what is happening to the corporate media structure, and what places like Fox and NBC and MSNBC and CNN are going to start to realize is that they need people like Tucker Carlson more than Tucker Carlson needs them. And on a much smaller scale, that's kind of the point that I've come to, is I can't ever imagine myself going back to work right now in corporate media. And I would argue that, you know, my old employer would need me much more than I need them from a financial perspective. And so that puts mainstream corporate media in a really tough position, because it used to be, I mean, when I joined the business, you would just fall over yourself for these jobs. You know, I can't imagine even 3 years ago being in a place to say, yeah, Fox offered me like a hosting position, I'd say no, but I don't think I would take it right now. Because again, I think that they need these folks who can bring in viewers and clicks and revenue more than those people need them, because there are so many platforms and opportunities for someone with a personality, with a following, to be able to monetize that on their own and cut out the middleman. And I think that you're going to see more and more of that. And the question is, what happens now? What happens now that these networks have hit this point where, gosh, people don't need these jobs. The people who are going to be really beneficial to our ratings, they don't need us anymore. And I think, and I said this when I quit my job in 2021, that I think there needed to be a dismantling of mainstream corporate media as it existed at the time. I think it needed to outright fail. And slowly you're starting to see ratings go down. Again, these big hosts are going to leave. People are canceling their Fox Nation subscriptions. I think that needs to happen in order for media in this country to be built back up and to live up to its core obligation. And I do think that that is going to swing the other direction. So media got so bad, it strayed so far from what its mission was supposed to be as the fourth estate. You have all these independent outlets popping up. I think there's going to become maybe too many at one point, and it's going to force corporate media to rethink what it was doing, rethink the place it found itself in, and to rebuild in a better way and to be stronger and actually serve people better.
I agree with that. However, I do think it's going to be hard to create that because you just don't, it doesn't get the same views like where you came from. It doesn't get the same attention and views that it used to get. So you can't, you're not making the same money, and then you're not able to pay your employees. So you can't have the same quality. And that's, I do believe that's happening in a lot of local media outlets right now, and they just can't pay people with experience to come and do it because they can't, they don't have the money to pay them.
But that's part of the crumbling.
They have to go somewhere else.
That's part of the crumbling. I think that's still part of the downhill slide, because like local newsrooms, King, I heard, is trying to hire like people basically out of college and pay them virtually nothing to work as a reporter in one of the largest markets in the country. And like back in the day when King was at its best, had like the stalwart reporters who were probably making well into six figures.
All of them. All of the different, all of them, King, Cairo, Como, all of them are hiring people that had been there, and they would stay for 20 years. They would stay for 20, 30 years and report and finish their careers there and go out with a, you know, big party and recognition. And now it's, you know, you're there 3 to 5 years and then you move on and they can't pay you anymore because you're not starting at a livable wage for a professional position, right? So, I mean, it's one thing if you're working at McDonald's and you're expected to work your way up. But when you're in that role and you used to be able to sit there for 20, 30 years and now there's no place to go.
No, I mean, when you're talking about like 60 grand a year, 50 grand a year for journalists in Seattle, that's not even close to what it used to be. But also when you're bringing in people for the local news, I mean, I watch my old station and some of the people they're hiring from like these teeny tiny little markets or out of college, and it's like, what? Right. And I think about how hard that job was to do well when I was doing it with 10 years of experience in the market. And I'm like, they're 22, you know, they don't know anything. What are they supposed to do?
People nipping at the, you know, they're not trying to get into that career anymore. It's like with replacing Dory, there's not people waiting in the wings for those jobs anymore.
Nobody's, no bench.
Nobody's going to school for that because they know it doesn't pay.
Right.
So then you go in knowing that you can make more in podcasting or in, you
know, an Instagram influencer.
Yes,
if you
exactly.
Want.
There's no motivation.
There was this whole generation, and I think it still exists, and they're starting to like get tired of doing actual work. There's this whole generation of people who went into TV news because they wanted to be on TV. Mm-hmm. And TV news fed into that because they just hired people who were attractive, didn't care about their actual competency to do the job. The audience got used to the shallowness of looking at people who were attractive. And then it was like, and I'm not saying attractive people can't be smart, but when you're hiring for that above all else, your product is going to suffer. And then you have people who, gosh, I just hired this because I just did this job because I wanted to be on TV. And now they're finding out, oh, they're going to make me shoot my own stories and work for $60,000 a year. Like, I can make that as an Instagram model.
Right.
And so it's weeding out people who weren't actually in it for journalism in the first place. But I think everything that we're talking about, lower salaries, bringing in lower quality of journalists, et cetera, people fleeing just a mass exodus to go do other things, I think that's leading to, you know, the downfall of the media as we've known it for the last 30 to 40 years, mostly, you know, the downfall in the last 15 years, I would say. But they're going to have to reinvent what a profitable lucrative model looks like that's also serving the public. Because just in the same way that the media got to a point where it was so biased that people were leaving, people who had integrity were leaving, and there were all these independent platforms that they could now use their skill and their recognition to monetize like we've done, there's going to become too many of these where I think people will also get sick of it. It's going to become something that people are like, wow, now I don't, you know, I can't pay for $105 subscriptions a month. I'm, you know, I've got, everyone has an opinion, et cetera, et cetera. And they're going to crave again that type of journalism that is down the middle, straightforward. And there is, I think, still an avenue for that to be offered by one of the news networks, like News Nation is trying to sort of slowly creep in underneath and build that. So I think just like the media failed, is failing now in epic fashion, I don't know what the future of what we're doing is when it comes to independent journalism and how flooded that market is going to be. And then is there a bounce back completely to the other direction where people are like, I just want to watch one station that's going to give me the news and not their opinion. And I realize that I'm questioning what, you know, in 10, 15 years this looks like. But I do think that you have to find a happy medium. And I think that we're in the process of the markets trying to sort out what that looks like.
Right. So I agree with you. I don't think it will recover. It will rebuild. Right. So it'll in a completely 100%. Different fashion.
Yes. That all the words I just said is what that's what I meant is it's not going to recover. It has to totally rebuild from the bottom up.
Yep.
And that is going to be a weird process. I'm just glad, you know, when I quit my job, I said to you and to others and I said to my agent at the time, too, is I don't want to sink with that ship. I don't want to sink with that ship. And I saw a sinking ship. And so I was like patting myself on the back today. I was like, you know, Brandy, you made a good decision. And obviously, thank you to subscribers who were supported it, or else, you know, my ship would have sunk as well. But it's been interesting. But I think we're all in the middle of a really weird time with the media. And the media does play a critical role. I mean, if the media is not there holding politicians accountable, then no one is. And so it does serve a purpose.
That aspect of it been is ruined. Scary.
It is scary. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. But anyway, just wanted to talk about the decline of corporate media and all of that. And we'll see what happens with Tucker. But I would be shocked if Tucker signed on to even like a Rumble or anything like that. He can make so much money. He's already built his brand, TuckerCarlson.com. I'm sure he's already gonna, he could probably get a million subscribers in a week. So just do that, Tucker. Just do that. All right, methodworks.com, one of our wonderful sponsors. If you have a business and you need help with anything tech related, MethodWorks is your go-to. Get in touch with Mark at MethodWorks, and he's actually offering right now, in addition to all the services that they provide, you know, 24-hour help desk, getting, did I say 24-hour help death? 24-hour help desk. If you have a small business that relies on technology and you've got something that at 9 p.m. at night goes out and you're going to try to call some conglomerate company with your tech to help with your tech needs, that's just not going to go well. And MethodWorks is a local company. They're there when you need them to help with any tech issues you might have. Mark at MethodWorks is also offering undivided viewers and listeners who want to check out their services a free security review and 1 month of free security monitoring, and can really take you through concerns that you might not even have thought of as a small business owner. If you've got data to protect or customer data to protect, you really do have a responsibility to do that. And it can be incredibly detrimental as a business to have some sort of data breach that you're not prepared for. So methodworks.com, tell them you heard about them on the Undivided Podcast for that free security review and 1 month of free security monitoring. Okay, we have a long list of things that are racist. I just learn every day something else that's racist that I never knew is racist. And I've got one more thing to add to the list. Apparently, elementary school music classes are racist. It's our segment, Unbelievable. All right, this is a story from our friend Jason Rantz. He always gets these great little tips on things happening in schools. And I feel like there's really been this movement especially during the pandemic when kids were learning from home and parents could finally see what their kids were being taught. And they were like, they could hear, you know, the classroom discussion on the computer. They're like, what? And so now we know more and more often what's happening in schools. But of course, schools have become at the center of, you know, just culture wars. And race has been a big part of that. So this is the article from Jason Rantz. It's titled School Board Cuts. School Board Cuts Music Class Over White Supremacy and Institutional Violence. Oh, for the love. Jason writes about an Olympia School District Board cut music classes because they're examples of white supremacy culture that caused significant institutional violence. So apparently the district, he writes, is expecting an $11.5 million budget shortfall. It has to make cuts. And so these music programs for fourth and fifth graders specifically were kind of on the chopping block for, is this something that we're going to cut to deal with this budget deficit? And parents were upset, understandably so. You know, I was in the honor band. I played the tenor saxophone. And it's a nice little respite, you know, get your creative juices flowing. Nicole, did you play an instrument?
I actually played saxophone as well.
No, you didn't.
I did.
I'm just learning this.
Yeah, but only 6th and 7th grade, I think.
Oh, so we're not going to have a jazz duo? I was in the honor band, man.
Oh, I did not get good. So I never got good at reading music. I was really bad at that.
Okay. Well, I guess we won't have a jazz duet with our saxophone. So yeah, parents were like, hey, come on, man. Like, our kids' creative juices get flowing and all that. So the district decided to cut band and strings from 4th grade classes to save about $500,000. But as Jason found out, there's this video at one of these school board meetings, it had to do with much more than just the budgetary issues. And I'm going to play these remarks from during this school board meeting. And I'll play the whole thing. And you're going to emerge the other end dumber when we start, because I want you to try to follow along with the mental gymnastics that this woman is trying to use to paint elementary school music classes as racist. Go ahead.
There are two things that have been very clearly expressed through the messages that we received from the community. The first is that it's intensely personally important to a number of folks. And second, that there's clear research-based data that it's healthy for young minds and brains to be engaged in musical education with instruments from a young age. That said, we also know from conversations with our elementary principals and from the exposition that we heard from our executive director of secondary education that there are problems with how elementary instrumental music is administered right now. We know that there are disproportionalities in how it's rolled out at each campus. We know that people experience different amounts of time of elementary instrumental music education. We know that there are some places where students never miss core instruction as a result of going to instrumental music. And we know that there are other campuses where that's a struggle. We also know that there are other folks in the community that experience things like a tradition of excellence as exclusionary. And I don't think that there's just one or two or 10 or 20 people that think that. But that's not unique to elementary instrumental music. We're a school district that lives in, is an entrenched in, and is surrounded by white supremacy culture. And that's a real thing. And there's nothing about string or wind instrumental music that is intrinsically white supremacist. However, the ways in which it is, and the ways in which all of our institutions, not just schools, but local government, state government, our churches, our neighborhoods, inculcate and allow white supremacy culture to continue to be propagated and cause significant institutional violence are things that we have to think about carefully as a community. And I think that we have to do that interrogation, and we have to address the ways in which it creates challenges for administering the educational day for our elementary learners while we retain the program. So those are my thoughts.
Wow. Those were some thoughts. I should just kept saying, and I'm like, there's more. Just a reminder, that was about elementary school music classes. This is where we found ourselves. Kudos to Jason Rantz for this story, because we wanted to talk about it yesterday. We just had so much going on with the end of the legislative session. This is insane. And I actually was quite shocked that the parents in the room managed to stay quiet during that entire rant about how they're just, it's institutional racism and violence and white supremacy because they want their kids to play an instrument in the fourth grade. We have to, this is one of those things where I talk about Undivided being political commentary for the anti-fringe. Every person with an ounce of reason, ration, common sense has to push back against ridiculousness like that. Like, if you want to cut the music classes because you have a budgetary issue, like, we can have that debate on the merits. But for you to suggest that kids who want to play wind instruments in the fourth grade or who want to be uber sensual saxophone players like Nicole and I are somehow perpetuating white supremacy and institutional violence, that is one of the most absurd things that I have ever heard. And the Olympia School District, and honestly, I wish parents in the room would have spoke out against this, but I think anyone who is consuming nonsense like that without openly and aggressively questioning it really at this point needs to take a deep dive into what they stand for and what's important for them. Because until we start rejecting nonsense like that forcefully, people are just, I mean, that was word soup. What did that even mean? And that's during a school board meeting where people didn't push back and say, are you calling wind instruments and band lessons for kids violent and white supremacy? We have to start aggressively pushing back against nonsense like that, because if we don't, I am truly concerned about what other kind of unbelievable stuff that is going to be thrust upon us. All right, if you are thinking about selling your home, why would you not reach out to our friend Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com of Wes Jones & Associates, one of our newest sponsors on the podcast. And Wes Jones has a wonderful track record in our region of getting you a top dollar for your house. They've got an innovative marketing strategy where they'll get the most possible eyeballs on your listing, whether it's locally or even internationally. Try to make sure that in a market like ours, which is, it's been better, right? The housing market has been better, but sometimes you just need to sell your home. And Wes Jones is going to be able to, with all his experience in the market, do what needs to be done to make sure that you get the best possible offer with the market right now. He also said, based on our conversations, that he does see a window of opportunity. If you need to sell your home and you're wondering, should I wait a little bit longer? He says there's an opportunity right now to even go back to getting cash offers, like we were seeing when the market was just wild, or competing offers, which obviously is good if you want to get that top dollar for your home. So visit sellwithwes.com. That is sellwithwes.com. Make sure to tell Wes that you heard about him on the Undivided podcast. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Okay, let's dip outside of Washington State really quickly before we take questions and comments from those of you who are watching the show live on Facebook, YouTube, Patreon, and Locals. And we always do, by the way, try to prioritize comments from subscribers. So make sure if you are a subscriber and you drop that comment in Patreon or Locals that we can get to you. There is a really good article. I want to talk about this today because I kind of want you guys to go read it. We are in this whole debate right now around substance abuse, and we've got this terrible drug crisis on our streets, and we have a majority party in Olympia that decided to end the legislative session without passing a law to make sure that drug possession is a crime. So starting on July 1st in Washington State, I laugh so I don't cry, drug possession will be de facto legalized, which means people can be out smoking, carrying any sort of drug, and it's not going to be an issue. And I am terrified about what that is going to do to a state and our cities that are already dealing with such a severe drug crisis, record overdoses. I mean, I shudder to think about it. But there's this whole debate back and forth about, there's a segment of the Democratic Party, you know, the uber progressives, who want drugs decriminalized because they don't believe that substance abuse disorder should be something that is a law enforcement issue. And then there are people who have common sense and realize that substance abuse disorder is oftentimes a law enforcement issue, because substance abuse disorder at its very worst can lead people to commit crimes, and a variety of crimes. We're not just talking about people who are out on Third Avenue stealing stuff from Target and hawking it to be able to get a quick hit. You know, I've talked to parents who they had kids who were addicted to drugs who would break into their home and steal stuff from their own families to be able able to continue their habit. And so the idea that someone can be severely in the throes of drug addiction and they're otherwise going to be just perfectly law-abiding people, I think that's very, very rare. So there's this whole debate about what benefit does arresting people who refuse to get treatment have? I think it's a useful tool. Again, it's very simple. It's the carrot and the stick approach. And I have personally interviewed, I did this great story with this young man who was arrested like more than a dozen times by Seattle police. And one of those arrests was the nexus for him to get clean. And I did an interview with him, the two officers and SPD who arrested him. And then he brought his wife and his baby. And the officers hardly recognized him because he'd put on like 40 pounds from when he was all methed out. But he talked to them about how being arrested, did it suck? Of course. But that one time, for some reason, in that period where he had to get sober in jail, was the genesis for him to turn his whole life around. And so I've heard those stories. So anyway, I want you to go read this story in the New York Post. The headline of it, How Compulsory Arrest and Recovery Could Help Homeless Addicts. And it's written by a man named Jared Klickstein, who is the guy you see in the photo right there. He's the author of this story, but he also was a homeless drug addict on the streets of Los Angeles. And so this story is this just wonderful, and it's sad, it's really, really sad, but it talks about just how, you know, he got into drug addiction and how his life just became absolutely miserable and unbearable, just, you know, doing drugs on the streets of Los Angeles and in California and sort of everything that he went through. And he said one afternoon, and I'll read from it, he said, one afternoon in a Los Angeles Panda Express outpost, I tried to stab a homeless person who'd attacked me. I got what I wanted. I was arrested and ordered to a 6-month spell in the LA County Jail. Those 6 months saved my life. He said, my jail experience was nightmarish, complete with racial gangs, routine violence, and a cold turkey heroin kick that involved 3 weeks of ceaseless vomiting. But jail also saved me. Not only did I break the chains of physical heroin addiction, I also received a much-needed lesson in life and living. I learned how to finally be grateful for things like a hot shower and sleeping on a real mattress. He says, I'm not suggesting jail is the answer for every addict. Some can quit without winding up in a cell, and an estimated 65% of all folks imprisoned suffering from a substance abuse disorder. For many, the penal system will only make their drug problem worse. But this is his sort of takeaway. And again, please go read the whole article. It's heartbreaking, but it's so important. He said, for some who can't quit, who destroy their relationships with family and friends and regularly break laws to feed their addiction, radical courses of action must be considered. And as my experience illustrates, to arrest the addiction, addicts may literally need to be arrested. So again, this idea, when we have so many examples, like the story that Jared tells about his own experience in California, when we have so many examples of people who, if not for being arrested, could be dead today, to have this fraction of the Democratic Party in Olympia that pushed so hard for a near complete decriminalization of substance abuse and drug possession, and in doing so, robbed us of any hope of being able to get this crisis under control. I really wonder where their head's at. I really wonder where their mind's at around this issue, to think that arrest can't be a solution, can't be a path towards sobriety. And so we're going to see what happens in the, what is it, April, May, June. They have 2 months to try to come back together behind the scenes, come up with an actual solution to the Blake decision. We've talked about it, the Washington State Supreme Court decision that nullified our drug possession statute. And then if they can come up with a solution, Governor Jay Inslee can call a brief special session and they can pass something. But I would really encourage Democrats who want to decriminalize these things or have the penalty be so, so low that you're basically taking away any power from law enforcement, I would encourage them to read stories like Jared's story and to ask themselves, why would you take that off the table? Why would you take arrests off the table in the most severe cases? Because what you're saying to me is you are okay with someone dying in misery on the streets with a needle in their arm than you are with them having an arrest on their record and having to sober up on the floor of a jail cell. Jail can mean that a person lives. And for you to take that option away, I think is not only horrific, but I think it is the opposite of compassion. All right, let's get to questions and comments from you guys. Y says on Patreon, let's see what this is about. About Senator Jamie Peterson saying, oh, gun manufacturers are out telling kids how cool it is to shoot a big gun. Y says on Patreon, that was my reaction just now. Who's telling kids it's cool to shoot assault weapons? I've never heard that. Eye roll. Yeah, I've never heard that. And again, if I'm missing something, if there was some big, like, kind of like Marlboro, you know, where they're like out, like, trying to, I don't know, get kids to smoke cigs. If there's some sort of marketing campaign I missed from the gun manufacturers that targeted kids who aren't old enough to buy weapons, please, please let me know. Lieutenant Dan on that same issue said, manufacturers are not advertising to kids. This is a huge straw man, 100%. The only place advertising to kids is TikTok and other social media outlets. Yeah, if somebody buys a gun, and they want to go, and I don't know what the restrictions are for videos that show guns. I know some platforms restrict that a little bit. So like when we have a video that shows a gun, I just blur it so that nobody takes my video down. But it's not the fault of a gun manufacturer. If someone else uses that gun in videos that kids are going to see, that's not their fault. How are they supposed to control that? And then you want to sue them over it? That doesn't make any sense. Chris on, I'm going to talk about it at the end. Okay. Chris said, the government seems to be confused. No, the government seems to be corrupt. I think that's in reference to a story we're going to talk about next. Kathy, about Nicole and I's dispute about, I think Bob Ferguson is likable to Democrats.
She used the same word I used with you this morning.
Oh, I wasn't going to say that you said he looked smarmy.
Sorry.
I disagreed with you, but Kathy says Ferguson is smarmy. I don't like reading comments with insults.
I know, I just had to.
The show is called Undivided. It's okay, Kathy, I get it.
He's putting his face out there as a politician, and we're saying you look like a father figure. You look a little smarmy. Whatever.
Can you look up the definition of smarmy for me quick and read it? Because I get it in context, but I'm not sure I know what the definition of smarmy is. Andy says on Patreon, Ferguson would take us to California levels of bad policy. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Honestly, I think we're almost there. Aaron says on YouTube, Nicole's wrong on this. Ferguson is perfectly likable. He's just a worm.
I balanced the comments. Okay.
Did you look, what's the definition of smarmy? Oh, thanks, Nicole.
Well, I don't even know that word.
Kathy says, I believe we need both term limits and age limits. I go back and forth on the age limit thing. Because as Nicole was saying, there are people who are Biden's age who are perfectly fine and would have no issue mentally running the country. So I really struggle with that. Let's see. Robert says, abundance of caution reads, keep the type of people out we don't like. What was the abundance of caution thing again?
Abundance of caution was the Inslee.
Oh, yeah.
Not letting people into the Capitol.
They closed the
today.
Capitol out of an abundance of caution for a bill signing. That doesn't make any sense. It was all about fear mongering, in my opinion.
So, can I give you the definition?
Yeah, of smarmy.
It's not a total insult.
All right,
it's just
go ahead, read it.
I don't know. Ingratiating?
Ingratiating? Okay.
Sure. In an insincere way.
Ingratiating in an insincere way.
Or excessive. Way.
Oh, so like,
yeah,
trying to get like a used car salesman kind
yes.
of.
Yes.
Okay.
See, that's yeah.
And you learned a new word today.
No offense to used car salesman.
Ingratiating. Yeah,
ingratiating.
No
yeah.
Some used car salesmen that are just fine, just fine. The yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
Let's see. Matthew says Washington State has a politician and a mental health problem. What they haven't talked about are criminals always going is that criminals are always going to be criminals, so they keep getting out of jail to reoffend. The law-abiding citizens pay the price again. How do these people get voted in? Good question. They only get voted in because more voters aren't watching the Undivided podcast and learning the truth behind what's happening in our state. Let's see. Matthew says, hi, Brandy and Nicole. As a subscriber, it's a lot easier to comment on the live chat rather than locals. All the cool kids are here in the live chat. Okay, Matthew, you just say, in parentheses, subscriber here, so that we go straight to your comment. Just alert us that you're a subscriber. Let's see here. Oh, do we just have comments from a lot of people named Matthew?
We do. I checked to make sure they're all different.
Yeah. Matthew says, that happened with me, Brandy. I got arrested and made the decision to surrender, got some help, found a great program, and today we share 4,610 days clean. Love it. Awesome. It says life is good, but we have to be willing to stop to get our lives back. That's the thing. No one can force you to be clean. At some point, there has to be a moment where you make the conscious decision not to use anymore. If that moment happens to be that you're on the floor of a jail cell and you have a day of sobriety where your mind is ready to make that decision, then so be it.
And you're like, I don't want to be here. Right. I'd rather be doing whatever, being a productive member of society. So that's why there has to be a consequence that you're choosing something over another thing.
And again, in the worst cases, for Democrats who don't want jail to be an option, I think you're saying that you'd rather someone die than go to jail. That's what I think you're saying. And I think that you think it's compassion, but it's not compassion. It's the opposite of compassion, to allow people to die on the streets with a needle in their arm or after taking Trank while the flesh rots off their bones. That is not compassion. And so I think that you need to reassess your definition of compassion, because it's leading to overdoses on our streets at record levels. Shame on you, frankly. All right, let's close with a sanity check, shall we, about the state of Washington and its confusion over how old a child needs to be to make life-altering decisions. One of the benefits of being an undivided subscriber on Patreon or Locals is that you get access to my brilliant op-eds that'll just enlighten you beyond belief. And I posted one a couple days ago that I didn't talk about on the show. If you want to read it, you do have to be a subscriber on Patreon or Locals. But I want to go through the general gist of it, because it's this issue that I think we've been combating and kind of contemplating a lot this year. And it's going to continue to be an issue moving forward. And has to do with parental rights, but also, at what age is a child capable of making decisions that can change the trajectory of their lives? The op-ed is titled, Washington State is Confused About What Kids Are Capable Of. And in it, I detail just some facts of ages that in Washington State, the law allows or does not allow a minor to be able to make decisions on their own. And it really centers around Senate Bill 5599, which is the bill we railed against, which is going to become law, that allows a kid who's seeking protected health care as young as 13 to run away to a shelter and their parents won't be notified. And that includes types of gender care and reproductive care. And I thought, you know, we're saying that some pretty young kids are capable of making medical decisions that could change their lives forever. So let's take a look at what I reference in this article about some ages. Again, there's a lot of laws governing age of consent, but I think these are important because it paints an interesting picture. So there is no minimum age in our state right now for someone to seek abortions, birth control, prenatal care. There's absolutely no bottom age to that. There's also no minimum age when it comes to puberty blockers and gender hormone therapy. It depends on the provider. Some will, some won't. If they can make it like basically act like it's part of your birth control regimen. So it depends, but there is no law on the books. Some of that is up to providers. At the age of 13 in our state, you can seek outpatient mental health treatment. At the age of 13, you can seek inpatient mental health treatment. You do not need parental consent, although your parent will be notified. At age 13, you can seek outpatient substance abuse treatment. At age 14, you can seek treatment for sexually transmitted diseases. And again, all this without parental consent or notification. Now, and all of that being said, there is a mature minor doctrine in Washington State that says basically if you can convince a healthcare provider to agree that you're a mature minor, you can get basically anything done without parental consent, which is a little horrifying. Now, I want you to compare that to some other age limits that we have on the books in Washington State. And I want you to tell me whether this makes any sense. So, for instance, age 15, you can get a learner's permit to drive a car. Age 16, you can get a driver's license. Age 18, of course, is the legal age of the majority, which is adulthood. 18, you have to be 18 in our state to get a tattoo without the consent of your parents. So you can get you can't get a tattoo until 18, but you can take hormone blockers to start the process of changing your gender. Does that make any sense to you? You have to be 21 to smoke a cigarette, to vape, to use weed. You have to be 21 to buy a beer. But again, when you look at those high ages, 18, 21, saying, hey, you can't even get a tattoo as an 18-year or as a 17-year-old without the consent of your parents, but you can run away from home legally, seek shelter, and get gender-affirming care without your parents even knowing. So I use the example in this article. Under state law, as it exists right now, a 14-year-old, okay, a 14-year-old, they could go get treatment for a drug addiction, they could start puberty blockers, and they could get an abortion all without the consent of their parents, but they're not even old enough to drive a car to get them to the clinic. Again, it's about, regardless of how you feel about the transgender issue or transgender care for minors, et cetera, you have to look at that and wonder, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think the government is really confused about what kids are capable of. And instead of applying a consistent lens on that, the government is applying ideology to it to decide what children should be able to do without the consent of their parents. So I think that there needs to be consistency. And if you think a child can run away from home and get health care without their parents knowing where they are at the age of 13, then I would challenge Democrats in Washington state to drop the age of majority to 13. If you think they can make a decision that serious, any child in Washington state without the consent of their parents, then let's make 13-year-olds adults. Let's make 13-year-olds adults in Washington state and let's see how that goes. Of course, you would never do that. You would never do that. So why are you allowing kids that young to make medical decisions for themselves that could alter the course of their life? It simply doesn't make any sense. It is insane. All right, that has been Undivided for this Tuesday, April 25th. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. And thank you for following us on this journey to watch what happens from the wings as corporate media crumbles. I don't know that it's fun, but I'm very fascinated to see what happens after the Tucker Carlson news and the Don Lemon news and how corporate media is going to try to reinvent itself to stop people like me from leaving. So we'll see. If you'd like to become an Undivided subscriber to get access to our exclusive Sundays with Subscribers, a show where we do in-depth interviews on controversial issues, or you can get access to some of our op-eds, a monthly live subscriber Q&A, which is always fun, which we're going to do here in a couple days, you can sign up at undividedpod.com. That's just your one-stop shop. So you go to that website, it'll show you how to watch the show, listen, and you can click on a link that says support the show, and you can find out how to become a subscriber on Patreon or Locals. From all of us here at Undivided, and by all of us, I mean me, Nicole, and sometimes Daryl. He's not here right now. He'll be here later. We appreciate you watching, we appreciate you listening, and we appreciate your commitment to this movement to give common sense a comeback. We'll see you tomorrow.